Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You are listening to Real College Podcast, and I'm your host, Jaga. This week, we are going to be airing the full interview that I did with Dessa a few weeks back before Chime came out, and Chime is now out. So here is the full interview with her. I won't talk too much just because it is lengthy. Without any further ado, here's Dessa.
Yeah, I guess we'll start with, so you have Chime is coming out on the 23rd. Was there a difference in writing process for this album as compared to your previous albums?
For this one, I worked with Laserbeak, my Doomtree cohort, and with the musician and composer Andy Thompson. And I think I worked more closely with the executive producers on this record than those I have in the past. So that means like more teaming up, you know, like more playing demos when they're kind of half finished, as opposed to only wanting to polish everything before playing it for people. And it really worked this time. Like we made a really great team, the three of us.
And what changed? Like, was it something in you that changed that allowed you to finally show people unpolished things?
Yeah, I think it was twofold. One, it was actually feeling a little more confident, so that I felt more confident sharing stuff that might be garbage. You know, like it wouldn't hurt my feelings so much if someone was like, this is not very good. Because I knew that I had done other stuff that is good in the past, so it's not like an indictment of my entire body of work if you think this chorus is lousy. And the other thing was, I think just like there's a particular chemistry in the personalities and in the skill sets of me and Andy and Laserbeak that I think like brought all of our best to the table.
And does that feel different than writing your previous albums?
I mean, writing is always a pretty solitary endeavor, you know? It's not something that you do, it's a tag team usually, you know, it happens when you're alone. But yeah, sharing work when it was more malleable and then readjusting our course, you know, making course corrections as we went, was a little bit different. I think I was more flexible on this record. And also, I think I was trying less hard to impress with intellect. Like, you know, you're always aware of how you present, you know. We're aware of how our bodies look to other people, of how our voices sound, of the way we speak, and we're all kind of monitoring how that's being received. And I think on this record, I was trying to figure out how to communicate a little bit less, like, with less thought towards reception, and I had less to prove and more to say, I think.
And what switched there? Was there like a moment that you felt a switch of like, I don't need to prove anything, I'm just gonna say what I have to say?
I mean, to be clear, it's not like I'm at like the top of Maslow's hierarchy here. I'm not like a fully actualized person who doesn't worry about what people think. I think I worry about that stuff all the time. But I think part of it's just with being older. Part of it's about having done this for a while now. So I've had some wins and I've had some losses, and can tolerate both. But I feel just more confident, like in my voice and in my craft. You know, like I'm a lousy baker, but I'm a pretty good stovetop cook. You know, and I know that if I'm making something that isn't turning out quite right, that mid-dish I can adjust. And also I think like a lot of my effort used to be expended in trying to make sure that I was being received as an intelligent person. And on this record, I feel like people who've heard my music have made their assessments. They either think I'm intelligent or they don't. There's other parts of me, you know, than intellect, which is true of everybody, right? Like part of your life is intellectual and part of your life is romantic and part of your life is lived as a daughter or as a son. And feeling more confident in bringing those other parts to bear. Yeah. There's a song called Ride, which is the first song on the record, that I remember thinking, ooh, do I feel comfortable putting this out? You know, it doesn't have a lot of fancy words in it. It talks more frankly about like a kind of dystopian perception of political current events. talks more frankly about like a hints at a dissatisfying like hookup, and and saying I'm gonna roll with that. That's also part of my true lived experience.
Yeah. So, Fire Drills is one of the tracks that is a single off of this record, and that song is pretty like upfront feminist type stuff. And you've written stuff like that in the past, but was this a conscious effort, sort of like in this political moment of like Me Too and Time's Up? Was it conscious, or was it something that you had already been sort of like mulling over?
Yeah, good question. I wrote the song, you know, before the Me Too movement started, and then kind of you find yourself in an unusual position of kind of releasing a fish into a raging stream. So I found myself, as all of us did, in the midst of this like political surge, but I hadn't written the song in response to it. Yeah.
Do you think that the response of the song has been changed by the moment that we're in?
That's a good question. I would guess so. I mean, I understand why it would be received as like, oh, here's a contribution to the Me Too conversation, irrespective of whether or not I had, you know, intended it that way. I understand why it feels like part of that exchange or that dialogue. So yeah, I guess probably, I imagine there must be hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands, I don't know, of female artists in my position who went, whoa, okay, I guess this particular song or painting or poem now lives in a new context than the one in which I wrote it.
How much do you, I guess because of that question, how much do you pay attention to like reviews or comments on new songs? Do you read those, or do you tend to steer clear of that?
The disciplined woman I want to be wouldn't read any comments, and the woman that I am does. Do I read all of them? No, but yeah, I'm probably just sensitive, and I'm eager to know how stuff resonates. That said, I don't write for responses. I figure my job is to try to write the truest thing I can and then trust that it'll resonate. And you don't always know how or with whom or on what grounds. So I don't hope to elicit any particular response as much as I trust true work to find its own way.
Let's see. What else? Is there a song off this new album that you're proudest of?
I am proud of the songs Ride and 5 out of 6.
Why are you proud of 5 out of 6 is out, so you that and this is coming out after the album's out, so why are you proud of those two?
I'm proud of 5 out of 6 because I think it manages to convey a feeling that I have found difficult to convey, which is this idea that that like grit and resilience and toughness aren't necessarily oppositionally opposed to sensitivity. Finding a way to communicate that idea that I think you can be both. I think you can live in a way that you are that you make yourself vulnerable, and that you experience big pain, and you're still tough as nails. Like, I think that works. But that's sort of tricky to make it rhyme. You know what I mean? So I was proud of that song in particular for having expressed a feeling that's important to me, but has kind of resists expression. For the song Ride, that's a departure from the stuff that I've done before. And that feels exciting, and it does feel riskier, you know? Like, on the occasions that I've been well received in my career, it hasn't been for any of the reasons that one might like the song Ride. And it feels good, like as a grown artist, you know, who's done this for a while, to say I haven't done anything like this, but this feels true and good, and I hope other people find something to like in it too. Yeah,
so between the time that you released your last album and now, you've sort of done a lot of different things, like a big variety. So like one of the things that you did was the concert with the Minnesota Orchestra. Has that influenced any of how you went forward with music after that experience?
Yeah, I think you know, the concert with the Minnesota Orchestra was like one of the performances of which I was most proud. It was a really ambitious concert. You know, it had a lot of moving parts. There were skits, and there was like really technical science information, and there was an orchestra. And all of those things are difficult to juggle on stage in real time, you know? But after having completed that that performance, I think musically, I did feel a little more confident walking away from it, in that even just being on stage with so many musicians to like better educate my own ear about the timbre, about the specific sound of a viola versus a violin, or of the way that orchestral percussion works. You know, it was an education in and of itself. And then it informed the new record really directly, in that one of the songs that Andy Thompson and I worked on together for debut at the orchestra made the record, Fire Drills, and another couple of songs that I'd been writing to debut during my solo performance with the orchestra also made it. One of them is Good Grief, which is one of the singles, and another one was the song called Velodrome.
Are there going to be any songs off this, because you have this, you do this thing in your albums where you sort of like, I don't know if you'd call it revision of old songs. Tell me a little bit about why you do that, and are there going to be any of those on the new album?
I would say that the only song that's been rearranged, you know, for the album that might already be familiar to listeners was probably Velodrome or Good Grief, if those listeners happen to have attended the Minnesota Orchestra concert. Yeah. But in the past, I have put out songs twice, essentially. And part of the reason for that was because after having toured with a live band, but having had my roots as a rapper who would, you know, usually play with a DJ, that the songs came home so different. You know, it was like we totally reimagined these songs with different instrumentation. And at that time, I thought, I wonder if I should capture these new versions, because they felt so distinct. And every once in a while, somebody in the audience would say, hey, I like the song. Do you have this version of it recorded anywhere? And I thought, note to self, it might be worth recording this version too. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But so there was just, you just decided, were there just like none that you particularly wanted to sort of rearrange for this round, or like, was it like conscious, or like just it didn't really happen?
I think for this one, happily, I had enough new material that I wasn't tempted to revise a familiar song, because we had a lot of like fresh grist for the mill. I don't know what decade that phrase was popular in, but nobody my age says grist for the mill, and I just want to acknowledge that.
Yeah, I want to say that I don't know what that means, and I just nodded, and I was like, yep, yeah, grist for the mill. That saying that we all use. I was also just recently announced that you have a book coming out in September. How did you balance writing a book and writing an album? I'm assuming at least they overlapped for at least part of it. How did you balance those two?
Oh man, for a while there it was just grind time, you know? I tried to stay inside as much as I could for several months, the better part of a couple seasons, and just focus. And I like wallpapered my apartment in post-it notes, you know, with ideas for essays or story arcs or songs. And yeah, I just kind of went stir crazy and banged it out. And I was aware of the fact that, you know, meanwhile, on the outside, it looks like I'm doing nothing. Do you know what I mean? So a lot of, you know, in the interviews that I'd have with reporters, it was like, so are you going to retire or what's up? Because it's sort of this like publish or perish environment. You know, if you don't have a record out every couple of years, like you're sort of out of the game. But meanwhile, I was just like, I'm working so hard. You know, this is the most productive period of my life. I just don't have anything to show for it quite yet. Yeah, so it was just grindy. Mm-hmm.
Did anybody legitimately ask you if you were going to retire?
100% yes.
Oh my god. Wow. That's a bold reporter. That is something I would never ask. Oh my gosh. Okay. For you, does it feel different to write a book and write essays than it does to write music?
Yes. I mean, I don't know if other rappers feel this way, but I do, in that sometimes there is a tension between how rad something sounds and how rad something means. Essentially, like, you know, trying to write beautiful images and deep concepts, and then to have to go over the whole thing and make sure it rhymes. I mean, that's just a lot of, it's a lot of boxes to have to check with every line. And then to make sure that there's like a cool percussive sensibility to it. I mean, it's just, that's a lot of levers. And in prose, I feel like there's more flexibility in a lot of ways. I mean, you're not governed by tempo or the kind of tenor, emotional tenor of the music. You know, you really have control of every variable as a writer, except for one. And that, as a musician, I get to decide how long the consumer's experience lasts. If I write a song that's 3 minutes and 30 seconds, I get to pick that. But when I write prose, the reader gets to decide how long their experience of the material lasts. And that's a really important variable, I think.
Is it going to be similar to something that we've seen in, like, Spiral Bound or Pound of Steam? Is it along the same vein, or is it similar and different? Like, how would you describe it?
Yeah, I think my voice as a writer will feel familiar to people who've read Spiral Bound or A Pound of Steam or, like, some of the articles that I published in magazines. But the content distinguishes it in that this is real memoir-y. So, you know, it's true stories, essentially, from the last, like, 10 years of being on the road, touring with Doomtree, striking out at romance a couple of times, and kind of indulging my fascinations as an amateur scholar of science.
Yeah, so along that vein, you did sort like a love experiment. I don't know exactly how to describe it. Can you tell us about that and what that was? And if that's influenced your music now moving forward.
Yeah, so as part of my performance with the Minnesota Orchestra, I knew that I wanted to have like a narrative run through the night that would sort of like serve as a scaffolding for each of the songs to sit on. And I was also going through like a breakup that took like 10 years to stick. And so after feeling pretty blue, like as a person offstage, I contacted a team of neuroscientists to see if I could locate the region in my brain in which romantic love resides. And to do that, I was referencing a lot of published material. So pay my respects here to Dr. Helen Fisher. But I was lucky enough to be taken on by scientists at the University of Minnesota, led by a team of scientists led by a woman named Dr. Cheryl Ullman, and this neurofeedback clinician. So that's the person who would like stick electrodes to your head to measure your brain waves and maybe try to change them. And her name was Penny Jean Grace Fire. And yeah, over the course of several months, we tried this kind of case study where we measured the love in my brain. We did an experimental intervention to try to change the way that my brain waves behaved. And then we re-measured the love in my brain to see if it did anything.
It's such a like fascinating thing to have done. But then you sort of have talked about the fact that it, in some ways, as much as it can be, it was a success. And a lot of your music previously was based on this love. How does that change this album, and how does that change your writing going forward?
Yeah, I mean, it's not the case that all of a sudden, like, I'm a disco dance act. You know what I mean? After having had a really melancholy discography. But I think I've always been interested in sort of a blending of feelings. And I was initially attracted to Doomtree because I thought that there was these moments of beauty. I mean, the way that Cecil Otter, for example, handles strings and orchestral samples, like, gorgeous. But there was also these moments of, like, aggression and unchecked anger. And my favorite stuff always, I think, has both of those things. There's an anger and there's a beauty. And so now, after having done this case study on my own brain, I think a lot of that experience finds its way into the music, even just in asking the questions that I was asking during that experiment. Like, can you decide to love somebody? I don't know. In the same way, like, I'm at the doctor and they hit my knee with a little mallet, I don't decide to kick my leg. That's just reflex. I can't help but react that way. is that how love works? Like, is it a choice? So, like, on the record, there's a song about free will. And in part, you know, I think that's a product of my rumination during that time. Yeah. And there's one, like, straight-up unapologetic summertime pop song. So.
So another thing that you've been doing sort of while you were, before this album came out, you were on the almost like praying track that Lin-Manuel put together. I guess if you could speak just a little bit about what, you are Puerto Rican. Mm-hmm. And so seeing something like Hurricane Maria happen, and what did that feel like, and what did it feel like when Lin approached you? Assuming he approached you for that.
Yeah. So my family on my mother's side is Puerto Rican. That said, most of them live in the island of, or, you know, in New York, not in Puerto Rico. But watching Lin's response, I mean, all music aside and all professionalism aside, it was just like, I felt really moved and awoken by how much one person can do. Granted, it's a person with considerable influence and serious resources, but like, because that dude decided to stay up for, you know, 6 days late into the evening and call every friend he knew and, you know, empty out his Rolodex and hustle hard to get things done. I mean, he, like, in a serious way, contributed to the Puerto Rican, you know, hurricane relief effort, supplementing a governmental response that is almost universally, it is, by every metric, like, slow and insufficient, you know? And how it just reminded me, like, dude, if I can do more. I want to be like that, you know? I can do more. I can try harder, and I can be better. And I just was so impressed by him as a humanitarian, let alone as a musician. Yeah.
Did you get to meet anybody that you fangirled over? Because I watched that video, and every moment for me was like, wow, holy star power, what?
Yeah, totally. You know, when I recorded, it was mostly just like me and Lin and Riggs at the Atlantic Studios. And already, I mean, I was just like, I was nervous. So in one way, it would have been so rad to, you know, be able to geek out over J-Lo or Rita Moreno or whoever. But on the other hand, it was probably all my nerves could take to be there in front of cameras as well.
So I guess more generally in regards to that, how does, or does being Puerto Rican play a role in your identity? Is that something that, like, you identify strongly with, or like how does that play into who you are?
Yeah, I think probably like a lot of biracial kids, there's an uncertainty about exactly the role that it plays, in that it's like, okay, I'm more Puerto Rican than my white friends, but I feel insufficiently Puerto Rican, you know, with my Puerto Rican friends. Like, okay, I can do a salsa, but my bachata sucks, and my, you know, my Spanish isn't as perfect. Isn't perfect, and I hate that. I wish it were. So, it's something that I'm desperately proud of, and then also sort of like embarrassed sometimes that I'm not getting right.
Yeah.
What about you?
It's been super complicated growing up. I grew up, I think I, like, kind of took it for granted that I grew up in that culture. And, like, my mom and my dad are both Puerto Rican. And I was like, oh, this is just, like, how I live. And then I went to UMD for a year for school and, like, was completely isolated in, like, a holy moly, where is my culture? Where to go? And I think, yeah, I also feel like, there was an episode of Code Switch where they talked about, like, you feel like imposter. You feel like an imposter, like a phony. Because I'm like, I've never lived there. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, I speak the language, but, like, I don't live there. And, yeah, it's like I'm too Puerto Rican for my white friends, but I'm not Puerto Rican enough for my Puerto Rican friends. So we're doing, like, for Radio K's Pledge, we're doing, like, a Love the Local theme this spring. And so what is, like, when you come back to Minnesota, what is, like, your go-to places you have to hit them before you go anywhere else? Like, if you're you're about to head out on tour, is there, like, a restaurant? Is there a bar? Is there a coffee shop?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a few favorites for sure. Lately, though, there's a newer favorite that I've discovered and been revisiting, the Birchwood Cafe. Have you been there ever? I would recommend it. So here's what it, what recommends it. Super woke ownership and like legitimate lived community engagement and activism, near as I can tell. Like by the register, you can snag a postcard if you're in a client to send off to Representative Amy, to Senator Amy Klobuchar to say, hey, it's important to me. Food justice issues, for example, are important to me. Their broth is banging. Their food is reasonably priced. And like I think once a month they have like a cinema series in the back room. It's cool. It's just well-sourced, where you're not compromising on like flavor in an effort to support your local farmers. It's really good. I also like The Wedge. I like Muddy Waters, which is, you know, in Uptown on Lindale. And I like, I'm a sushi fan. I like Fujiya quite a bit, yeah.
So we, I think the last time we had you in for an in-studio Radio K was like after Parts of Speech came out, right? But you've been around with Doomtree, and so you guys have been to Radio K a few times. What does it, I guess, what does it mean to you to have, to, for Minnesota to have a college radio station like that?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think having stations that are willing to take risks, having stations that are willing to test new and local releases is super important to the health of a musical community. And I think in any musical community and at any level, it's good to have a diversity of voices. And I don't mean that in the like Montessori air quotes, like diversity, like I'm checking off, you know, ethnicities. I mean like different tastes, different backgrounds, different criteria to share music. I think that matters. Like music listeners are different, and I think station programmers ought to be too. So yeah, I think it's important to the healthy community.
That is all for this week's episode of Real College Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Real College Podcast is a production of Radio K. It's produced by Ben Hallam, Liv Riggins, and Alex Schumacher. I'm your host and managing editor, Jacob Maldonado Medina. Thank you so much for listening. Head over to radiok.org/realcollegepodcast to check out our previous episodes, and make sure you tune in every Monday for more arts and cultural coverage.